In 721, the great capital of the northern kingdom of Israel fell to the Assyrians. The siege was begun by Shalmaneser V and was completed by Sargon II in 721. And so Israel was taken away from the north, and that nation as such was never restored. Any Israelites of the tribes in the north that came back at the time of the return of Judah, but they would have been here and there. But God never did bring back that country which had come to be called Israel there in the north. They were rejected of the Lord, and now His attention was focused upon His people, the house of Judah. Also remember that early in the days of the divided kingdom, many of the peoples who lived in the tribes up here in the north had moved down into the south. So there would have been some of them down there as well. But this is the kingdom of Judah. And at the time that Israel in the north was taken away, Samaria destroyed, the king of Judah was Hezekiah. Hezekiah was one of the best kings of Judah, one of the best kings all during the history of Israel. And Hezekiah ruled during the time of the last king of Israel in the north, Hoshea. So that Hezekiah knew the danger that was up there. He knew the danger of Assyria. And when Samaria fell, one might wonder how Hezekiah felt about the security of his own realm. It was some years after that, that the Assyrians did come back down. They came back being led by Sennacherib. And they came down and came over here on the coast, taking various cities over here. And Sennacherib had plans to take Jerusalem. So he sent a messenger of his, who was a high-ranking officer in his army. And this man's name was Rabshakeh. Rabshakeh came up before the gates of the city of Jerusalem with the Assyrian army accompanying him back here, at least part of it. And he shouted in the language of the people there on the walls and insulted Hezekiah and insulted God. And by far the worst thing he did was to insult God. He equated Jehovah as, he equated him with the other gods that were all round about. Those gods had not been able to spare the cities and kingdoms that worship them. Why should Jehovah be able to deliver Jerusalem out of the hands of Sennacherib and the Assyrians? So Sennacherib both sent this message through Rabshakeh personally, and then he wrote a letter reaffirming these insults and so on to Jehovah and to Hezekiah. Hezekiah took this matter and prayed to God about it, and God spoke through Isaiah and told Hezekiah, I have heard what this man has said. I have heard what Sennacherib has said. And I will put my hook in his nose and my bridle in his mouth, and I will turn him back by the way which he came. And he shall not raise up a mound against this city, nor shall he fire an arrow toward this city. True to his word, the Lord went out over the camp of the Assyrians and smote in one night 185,000 of their principal men, their leaders. And the next morning when the camp arose, they discovered all of these dead men amongst their number. And needless to say, Sennacherib was shocked, terribly upset. And he rose up, took his army, and went back to Assyria. And some years later was slain by his own sons while he was worshiping in the house of his God. So God had spared Judah and Jerusalem because they were under good King Hezekiah. Hezekiah called together the tribes, even the people in the north that were left. He called together, sent messengers, even up here in the north that no longer was even recognized as a separate country. It was now merely a province in the Assyrian Empire. He sent messengers up there saying, come to the Passover that we're going to have. And the text says that this was a Passover, the likes of which there had not been since the days of Solomon. In the over 200 years since the days of Solomon, there had not been a Passover held like this one. And they gathered together and they worshiped God. And there were people from the tribes in the north. I remind you, those tribes as a whole were not there. But there were remnants here and there of those tribes. Those people that came down were not clean ceremonially and therefore were not really qualified to partake of the Passover. But Hezekiah prayed to God and said, "Will you heal these people and let them take the Passover?" And the Bible says God did, that He healed these people. He forgave them. The merciful God realized that these people have not been following Me, and therefore they have not done that which would render them clean. And God forgave them and enabled them to observe that Passover. And so Hezekiah was a good and great king. Now during the days of Hezekiah, there was a messenger who came. And this messenger was sent by a man called Merodach-Baladan. Merodach-Baladan was, this new Babylonian empire had not come yet. But Merodach-Baladan was seeking to gain independence for the Babylonian kingdom from the Assyrians who were up here. He did not succeed. But it is interesting that he did send messengers to Hezekiah at a time that Hezekiah had gotten very ill. And when these messengers came, the victory of Israel, or the victory of Judah over the Assyrian army of Sennacherib, that had not been long before. And here come these messengers from Merodach-Baladan. Now Hezekiah had been terribly sick. He was going to die. God miraculously delivered him so that he was alive. And these messengers were there from Merodach-Baladan to congratulate him and also to seek his help against the Assyrians. Hezekiah had the opportunity to tell these men, now right out here was where the Assyrian army was camped. Innumerable. There was no way that we could have defeated this Assyrian army. But our God, Jehovah, overcame this army, defeated them without our doing anything at all. And that whole great big army had to go back home. And Hezekiah could have told them about his illness and how Jehovah, his God, had healed him, even when it was certain he was going to die. And if Hezekiah had done that, you see, he could have used this opportunity to evangelize for Jehovah, to tell about the glory of the Lord. But instead, what he did was to show them what a rich king he was and what a powerful king he was. Hezekiah, like all of us, had feet of clay. And he fell for this opportunity to exhibit some pride. So he showed his glory and not the Lord's glory. And therefore Isaiah prophesied. He said to Hezekiah, "This is what the Lord says." Now Isaiah had come to him and had said, "Hezekiah, who were these men that came to see you?" And Hezekiah said, "Oh, these were messengers sent to me from Merodach-Baladan, the king of Babylon." What did you show them, Hezekiah? "Oh, I showed them everything. I showed them everything. There wasn't anything I didn't show them." Now Isaiah knew that already. But then he delivered the message of the Lord. He said, "Yes, that's what you've done all right. And this is the word of the Lord. The day is going to come when men from this very kingdom, the Babylonian kingdom, they're going to come here and they're going to take all of those things that you showed them. They will take them away." When Hezekiah had found that this would be after his day, then he said, "Then the will of the Lord be done." In other words, he wasn't going to worry too much about it if it was going to be later on. But what an opportunity was lost. Nevertheless, Hezekiah was one of the best kings of Judah. When Hezekiah died, his place was taken by Manasseh. Manasseh, arguably the most wicked king that Israel had ever known, either Israel or Judah. Manasseh did everything that the people who lived there before the Israelites took the country had done. And the warning had been given that if you go in Israel into this land and you do the things that the nations that there before you have done, then you will be cast out of this land, that the land itself will throw you up and throw you out of this land. And Manasseh did every bit of that. He worshiped the Baal, the Baalim. He worshiped the Ashtaroth. He worshiped Molech. He offered his children to Molech, passing them through the fire, meaning he burned them to death. He did everything in the book. And in 2 Kings 23:26, and in 2 Kings 26 and verse 4, or 24 and verse 3 rather, 2 Kings 24 and verse 3, and in Jeremiah 15 and verse 4, three times, the point is made that in Manasseh and in the wickedness that he did, the balance was tipped and it went beyond what God's patience was willing to endure. And I've always thought about it like one of these old balances like this. And you've got the weight down here and here's what Manasseh is doing. And here's God's patience. But finally, or, you know, it depends on which way you want to do it. Say, here's God's patience. And Manasseh keeps working, and doing all his evil until finally the side flips down here and God can no longer endure. And Manasseh is the one who is credited with bringing God beyond what his wrath would bear. But during the reign of Manasseh, there was a very unusual thing that happened to him. A thing that sometimes is overlooked. The Assyrian Empire was still the empire that was in power. And they had two rather powerful kings there, even in the last 7,500 years of the Assyrian Empire's existence. One of these kings was called Esarhaddon. The Bible does not name him as the one who did this, but the time would have to work out for it to be Esarhaddon. Esarhaddon came over here into Judah, where Manasseh was the ruler, and here is the little dab of Judah on the map. He comes over here, and he takes Manasseh prisoner, puts him in fetters, and takes him away into captivity. And for some time, Manasseh is in captivity until he realizes that Jehovah is God, and he realizes what he's done, and he prays to God. And he is allowed to come back to Judah, where he seeks to undo a lot of what he had done. But it is too late for him to undo it now. So that chastisement is going to happen. That's positive now. But even so, the depth to which it would go was still negotiable with God at this point. When Manasseh died, he was followed by his son Amon. Amon was just as wicked as Manasseh ever was, except that Amon only lived 2 years and did not get very far in his efforts to follow the course of his father. Now, when Amon died, he was followed by his 8-year-old son. That 8-year-old son was named Josiah. Josiah. Oh, my, what a king. It might be argued that he was the best king that Judah ever had. He was one of the finest men that we see in the whole history of the monarchy. When he began, he was 8 years old. And as the years went by, I'm looking for a marker here. As the years went by, he began to seek the Lord. In the 8th year of his reign, he began to seek the Lord. Now, sometime along in here, there were some prophets. First, there was Zephaniah. And Zephaniah came along before the reforms of Josiah began. And Zephaniah came and he just thundered the wrath of the Lord. He said that the judgment of God is going to come upon the world. And some students, one in particular, one commentator, says Zephaniah is the hottest book in the Old Testament. The hottest book in the Old Testament. You read it and you'll see what they're talking about. The judgment of the Lord is coming upon the whole world, and particularly upon Judah. That's what Zephaniah announces here at the very threshold of all of the reforms that Josiah is going to initiate. Now, at this very time, remember that map? Let me show you that map. There is another cloud rising on the horizon, and this cloud is going to take the place of the Assyrian cloud. This new cloud that is beginning to rise is the new Babylonian Empire. In the year 625, Nabopolassar, ruler of the Babylonians, established independence from the Assyrians. So, at this point, he has managed to make a break between Assyrian control to the north here and the Babylonian kingdom to the south. He has managed to gain independence, and he begins to work with the Medes, to work with him to overcome the Assyrians. So this is on the horizon. Now there's a prophet in Israel at this time who sees that this great empire is going to rise. There's going to be this Babylonian empire. And this prophet's name is Habakkuk. Habakkuk. And Habakkuk is concerned. He is concerned with the same thing that Zephaniah is concerned about, and that is the wickedness of this people, Judah. And he wonders, now how is, Lord, are you going to just let this go? What are you going to do about it? The Lord said, no, I'm not going to allow the wickedness of Judah to go unpunished, Habakkuk. It is extremely upsetting to me, and I'm going to deal with it. And I am going to use the Chaldeans, which was the name for the Babylonians. I am going to use the Chaldeans, and I'm going to punish Judah. I'm not going to let them get away from all the, for all the wickedness that they've done. Then Habakkuk said, but Lord, how can you do that? Because the Babylonians, they are a totally wicked people. God said, oh, I'm not going to let the Babylonians get away either. I'm going to use their wicked tendencies to chastise my people, but then I will punish the Babylonians for their own wickedness. I will not let them get away. So Habakkuk says, so you mean that here we are sitting here and we know that the Babylonian Empire is going to come down here and it's going to chastise us? Yes. Okay, now what do I do? Habakkuk says, so what am I going to do? He says, all I can do is wait on the Lord. There's not a thing I can do. And he made this beautiful point in the last chapter, the third chapter. He says, if the herds fail and the vineyards don't produce, and it went on talking about all of the things that can happen to an agricultural society, and we don't have anything, stalls are empty, I will wait on the Lord. That's what I'm going to do. You know, I don't think many of us have had any worries of the depth and the breadth and the extent that these people had. Because it's rare that we've ever been faced with a thing that we knew that there was no way we could do anything about this. And we were so completely blown away by the enormity of the thing that was about to happen that we realized there's not a thing we can do but stand there and let it happen. And trust in the Lord. To die or to live or whatever happens, we will trust in the Lord. It was a great lesson. And about that time, there was another great prophet in the Bible who began his work. And that prophet's name was Jeremiah. Now, Jeremiah loved Josiah. And Jeremiah was one who thought maybe Josiah, he is the one that maybe we can get things back on track. And it looked like that. It looked like that for a good while. I'll say more about that in a moment. And then there was a fourth prophet. And his name was Nahum. Now, you remember that I told you that before the fall of Israel back in 721, that there had been a whole cluster of prophets to come along. There had been Jonah early. Then there was Amos, and then there was Hosea, and then there was Isaiah, and then there was Micah. There you have a whole cluster of prophets. Do you see that at any great time of calamity, at any very crucial turning point in God's people's history, He sends His prophets in groups, in droves, to try to get His people to listen. And here we have a whole other group of prophets that come along. Zephaniah, Habakkuk, Jeremiah, Nahum. And when Nahum came along, the fall of the Assyrian Empire was already in view. I mean, prophetically. It was a very few years till Nineveh would fall. And Nahum prophesied against that city. And in graphic terms, he told how enemy chariots would go rolling and rumbling through those cities. And foolishly, through the years, people have gone looking for sensationalism and thinking that they have read about automobiles and Nahum and completely missed the point of what Nahum is talking about. He is talking about the day when a great city, the city of Nineveh, would be overthrown, and how the rumbling and jostling of chariots rolling through the streets and men fighting and taking that city, that's what Nahum is talking about. He pronounces the doom upon Nineveh and upon the Assyrian Empire also, because he could hardly lose a city such as Nineveh and stand. So here we have these great prophets, and we have Josiah. Now Josiah began to seek the Lord, and he really began to turn to the Lord in the 12th year of his reign. And in the 18th year of his reign, he set about to have the temple restored. So they went in there and they were cleaning it up and they were working and working. And in all this stuff, on all this debris in there, they found a book. It was the book of Moses. And they said, "We need to bring this to the attention of the king." So they brought the book in before Josiah. Josiah had never heard. Now he had learned, he sure knew something about the Lord. And he sure knew something about the Lord's will. And I wonder at the providence of God in moving the scribe to read this portion. "It shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of Jehovah thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Cursed you will be in the city, and cursed you will be in the field. Cursed shall be thy basket and thy kneading trough. Cursed shall be the fruit of thy body and the fruit of thy ground, the increase of thy cattle and the young of thy flock. Cursed shalt thou be when thou comest in, and cursed shalt thou be when thou goest out. Jehovah will send upon thee cursing, discomfiture, and rebuke in all that thou puttest thy hand unto to do, until thou be destroyed, and until thou perish quickly because of the evil of thy doings whereby thou hast forsaken me." And I don't know how much of that they read, but Deuteronomy 28 may have been the place. There are few passages it could have been, but that would have been one of the main passages that they might have read to Josiah about what the Lord said would happen if his people forsook him. And when Josiah heard this reading, he was absolutely horrified. He said, "Oh no, you mean this is about to happen right now?" So he had a delegation to go to a prophetess who lived there in the city. Her name was Huldah. He said, "Go and ask her about this." So they went to the house of Huldah and they said, "Josiah has sent us to ask you about the will of the Lord. What is going to happen?" And Huldah said, "The Lord indeed is going to bring upon you these things that He has promised to do. These things that the law tells of. He is going to bring those things upon you. But He is not going to do it in the days of the man who sent you." So He's not going to do it in the days of Josiah. It will be after the days of Josiah that these terrible consequences will come. So, we have Manasseh following Hezekiah. We have Manasseh. We have Amon. And now we have Josiah. Now, in the year 612, a force of Babylonians under the leadership of Nabopolassar and a force of the Median people joined together, and they went up here and they fought against the city of Nineveh. And the river, the Tigris River, actually undercut a portion of the wall, causing that wall to fall. And these forces combined went in there and destroyed the city of Nineveh. And so completely was it destroyed that the site of it was forgotten. And in the early years of the last century, well, no, it's not. I've had to change. We're in a new situation now. The century before last, in the 1800s, in the early 1800s, there were some Europeans, statesmen, consuls, people like that, living over in the area that is now called Iraq. And certain of the villagers would bring them artifacts. And they found out where these artifacts were coming from. There were these hills out there. And so these statesmen of Europe began to hire workers to go and dig into these hills. And one after another, they found that what was thought to be merely hills were actually the ruins of these magnificent cities that existed there over 2,500 years ago. The Assyrian Empire did not immediately fall. Instead, it pulled back and established headquarters back over here near Haran and Carchemish. In 605, Nebuchadnezzar, well, no, wait, I can't go that far. I've got to tell you something else about Josiah. In 609, Pharaoh Necho was taking his army up through Judah. He was going up here to help the Assyrians, to hold on. And the reason why he was doing that was he did not want there to be a brand new Babylonian empire. He didn't mind a Babylonian kingdom being over there, but he was worried, and for good purpose, that if there arose a whole new empire, it would affect Egypt. So he was traveling up here to fight against the Babylonians on the side of the Assyrians. And as he went through Judah, Josiah went out to meet him, because Josiah did not want him going to the help of the Assyrians. And so he met him in battle and was destroyed. Josiah was killed in that battle. Now, I know that some of you have known men who were good, devoted men for the cause of the Lord. And when they died, we said, oh no, how can we do without them? Jeremiah felt that way about Josiah. He was just crushed. The hope that we had, now what are we going to do? And he wept for Josiah, and God said, Jeremiah, don't weep for Josiah. He's the lucky one. Now, wouldn't that make your hair stand on end? If you were now told, oh, don't weep for that man that's just been killed in the battle. He's the lucky one. Instead, you weep for the one who's going to be taken away and he'll never see his home again. And the one that he was talking about, that the Lord was talking about there, was a son of Josiah named Jehoahaz. He was put upon the throne by the people there of Judah. But when Pharaoh Necho came back through, he said, no, I'm not going to have him on the throne. So he picked another man, Eliakim, changed his name to Jehoiakim, and set him upon the throne. But Necho did not manage to hang on very long because the Babylonians, under the leadership of the son of Nabopolassar, a very capable general named Nebuchadnezzar, came up here and he fought the Egyptians at Carchemish, defeated them, drove them away, and the Egyptians were running just, you know, as fast as they could retreat with an army, heading down here to Egypt. And Nebuchadnezzar was in hot pursuit. And when he got down here, close to the border of Egypt, word came to him by swift horsemen that his father, Nabopolassar, had died. Well, the quickest they could get there would be a few days if they were riding fresh horses all the way. So he knew, I have got to get back to Babylon the quickest I can. This is one of the few times, therefore, that we have people striking out straight across the desert. And he took a few attendants and struck straight out across the desert, heading for the city of Babylon. And he got there, and he was crowned the king of Babylon. And he was the only great king that Babylon ever had. He ruled from about 605 to 562. Now, while he was going on back, his army was moving its way slowly up through the Philistine provinces, through Judah, and they were taking captives and hostages and accepting the allegiance of the various countries. And when they got to Jerusalem, they took captives and hostages there. And among those captives and hostages that they took there were a man named Daniel, that's his Hebrew name, and Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. Those were their Hebrew names. But we know them a lot better by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and we know Daniel better by his Hebrew name. It's interesting. But he wrote the book. So in his book, he refers to himself primarily as Daniel, except when he is addressed by someone else, a Chaldean or someone like that. But he was taken captive at this time along with these friends of his. And they were taken up here with the army, taken all the way back here to the city of Babylon. About 1,000-mile journey for this young man and his friends coming up and around this way. At that time, Jehoiakim says, Okay, I will be subject to you. So he agrees to be subject to Nebuchadnezzar. Meanwhile, Daniel comes before Nebuchadnezzar. He is a very brilliant young man. His friends are brilliant young men. And so Nebuchadnezzar gives command that certain men like this, young men like this, are to be chosen from among the captives. They're to be given training in order that they may stand before the king. And so Daniel and his three friends begin their training. And immediately Daniel is confronted by a situation that he cannot tolerate. When he is confronted with eating what the king supplies for reasons that are not specified, he did not believe he could eat those things. So what was he going to do? So he went to the overseer of the eunuchs and he said, listen, I would ask a favor. I would ask the favor that you let me and my friends eat vegetables and not eat that which the king sends. The overseer said, oh, I don't know if I could do that because, I mean, if I change what the king sends for you to eat and then you get sick, my life might be in the balance. Daniel said, well, do this. Give us the vegetables for 1 week and then look at us. See how we're doing. The overseer was a reasonable man and he said, all right, we'll do that. So he gave vegetables to Daniel and his friends. Probably that means it was the meat that the king was sending to them that they felt was unclean. And at the end of the week, the overseer checked them out, and they were actually looking better and healthier than any of the others. And so the overseer said, okay, then that's no problem. You just go ahead and eat the vegetables the rest of the time. And so 3 years of training were to be undergone. And during this time, Daniel would be taught the wisdom of the Babylonians and the learning and the language and all of that. Tonight, we're going to learn what else happened to Daniel. We're also going to learn some more things about Jeremiah. We're going to learn some things about Ezekiel tonight. Because since I have this opportunity in the way we're doing this, it is an opportunity I almost never have. And that is to tell the wonderful stories that are found in these prophetic books, such as Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. We hope you can be back tonight as we continue our study. So what we'll be looking at tonight is we will actually see the fall of the city of Jerusalem. And we will see the captivity as it goes on. A captivity which began at the time that Daniel was taken captive. A captivity that was prophesied by Jeremiah to last for 70 years. And we will see that captivity as it comes to a close. As we will see yet another empire arise to overcome the Babylonian Empire, and that will be the Persian, the Medo-Persian Empire. We hope you can be back tonight. There may be someone here today who is not a Christian, and if that be the case, I always like to suggest that you think about someone like Daniel. I don't know if it makes a difference or not. It looks to me like it would. If you were to think about Daniel and how admirable it was for him to be willing to pay any price to be a child of God, it would stir you to imitate his example. I was reading yesterday about an early disciple called Polycarp. He was one of the so-called early Christian martyrs. He died about the middle of the second century. He was burned at the stake. And we have an elaborate account given of his death. And there was a writer who wrote of it in our day, looking back on that story of Polycarp. And he made a statement that I think of a lot of times. He just basically said, "When I see the kind of people these people were, like Polycarp, who died at the stake, burned. And when I think about Daniel and I think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego," I added that part. This fellow then says something like, "It makes me ashamed to call myself a Christian. Because, you know, I know that I have not given, I have not sacrificed. I have not faced the trials and the struggles that these people faced." So I can really sympathize with that feeling. But that ought to just stir us all the more to want to be faithful to God, devoted to God, willing to be faithful no matter what it takes. And if you're not a Christian, you ought to be one today. You ought not to let one more moment pass till you become a Christian, devoted to the merciful God who will save you both now and in heaven. If therefore you are willing to become a Christian, we want to encourage you to do it at this very time as we stand and sing.